Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Ecclesiastes is a continuation of the author trying to show things that are futile or vain. This book is so contemporary with our age because too many times we put such great stock in things and achievements and that type of thing that we forget that, like many of these folks we've prayed about tonight, when you come close to death, all the things that seem so important suddenly don't seem so important anymore. And all the things that didn't really seem that important in our lives suddenly take on huge dimensions of meaning and purpose. And I think the author of Ecclesiastes is pointing up to us again and again the shallowness of life if all we have is this world and a humanistic understanding. It's really shallow. It's really meaningless if that's all there is. Now, verses 1 through 7 are going to deal with religious formalism, perfunctory religion. Now, we need to recognize that one of the things that turns the world off is fake piety. Piety that says with the mouth how much they love God, but with the life, don't get in my way, I'll stomp you to death. Piety that prays beautiful prayers, but lives sinful lives. Piety that seems to be more of an outward show than it is an inner faith. Now, you can go too far the other way. You can have an academic faith that's so sterile, though true, that nobody's attracted to it. But I've also met folks who are so sweet, and it's like eating pure honey. I just don't want to be around it too long, you know. I'd rather be around someone who I think is genuine, though they may not act like everybody thinks they ought to act in every instance. Our world is in a trap of fakes. We have fake politicians. We have fake preachers. We have fake businessmen. Everybody is seeming out to get something out of us and get something out of what they do. And I think Coley here really says some words that we ought to look at our life afresh and new with the motivation that drives us for our service. Let's read verses 1 through 7. I'm reading my translation, and you follow me, please, in yours. Guard your steps as you go to the house of God, and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they are doing evil. Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. Rather, fear God. Now, the first phrase here, guard your steps. If I had to paraphrase that, it's talking about analyze your motives and lifestyle. The people that are fake religionists or have a false perfunctory piety don't realize they have that kind of lifestyle. They don't realize that what they're doing is sin. These men are doing, and these women, these young people, are doing in the name of God what they feel is right. But God says it's the sacrifice of fools, and it's a sin. I guess some of the most grievous crimes in all of history have been crimes done in the name of God. Isn't it the tragedy of tragedies that someone would try to be serving God and trying to do his will, and God would say it's a sin? Now, I think each one of us need to analyze the motives behind why we serve God. I'm going to be very honest with you. There are many people in the ministry for egotistical reasons. There are many people in the ministry because it seems to be an easy way of life. Well, boy, they haven't been around some people I've been around. Ministry is not easy to me, and I didn't volunteer for this thing. I want to tell you, I was drafted. It used to scare me to death to be up in front of people. But there are people all around us who are fake because they've never analyzed why they do things. When I first went into the ministry, I knew that Peggy and I were just extremely active in churches. We would go every night to everything. And one day I got to think, Bob, why are you doing all this? And you know, I think it was because that I wanted God to love me and bless my ministry, and I thought I could earn his blessing by all that I did. And I want to tell you, God turned my life around when I realized that I have nothing to bring God. Zero. My effort, my dedication, my zeal, add up to zero. It's Jesus Christ, the acceptance of me in his death, that made all the difference. And I still do that, just like I did before. I push myself. Well, any church would ever push me. But the attitude has totally changed from one of being accepted by God to the overflow of love and gratitude because of what he's done for me. It's made all the difference in the world in my attitude about what I do. Analyze why you do what you do. Notice it says, as you go to the house of God. This guy is not saying, assemble yourselves together. Friends, they had no problem with going to church. They were in church every time the temple door was open. They were in church. They prayed three times a day. Many of them fasted three times a week. They had all these festivals. They had no problem with going to church. Ecclesiastes is not saying, you need to get to church. It's saying, why are you going to church? See, the problem is not that God's going to check our attendance. God's going to check our motive. And so this preacher's not saying, you need to get to church. He's saying, why are you going to church? Now, the house of God has got to refer to the temple here, and it can't refer to the synagogue. The synagogue is never called the house of God, so it's got to be the temple. Now, when it says, draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of food, this Hebrew word to listen is a word that implies not only the hearer in James that hears the word of God but does not act on it, but this Hebrew word implies hearing with the understanding of obedience toward what you hear. It's an active listening. It's a listening toward the view of participation in the will of God. So it's not just listening, but it's a listening, obeying, listening, doing, active listening, if you please. Now, when he says the sacrifice of food, by the way, the little word to offer here is not the usual Hebrew word to offer a sacrifice. It's a different word, and exactly why it's here, I don't know. The reason I think it's here is, there are people who say that the sacrificial system never was of God, that God's not pleased with, and they quote a bunch of things from the prophets and say the sacrificial system is all wrong. No, the Bible doesn't say the sacrificial system is wrong. What the Bible says over and over again is that the man who participates in the sacrificial system without understanding the proper motivation and the reason behind it is a fool. The guy who comes to church and sits in our pews and gives to our church and joins our Sunday school and sings in our choir and goes out visiting and all the rest, but doesn't understand why he's doing it, a fool. God looks at the heart. The motivation is the key. Now, the action is great. And I'm all for more action in the church. But why you do what you do is the key. It's with sacrifice. I've been in some of the most beautiful services where the liturgy they used was excellent. The Roman Catholic funeral has the best liturgy for funeral I've ever seen. It quotes the right verses. It goes to the heart of the issue of death. It goes to the crucifixion of Christ for salvation. It's the most beautiful liturgy. But everyone I've been to has been read in a repetitious monotone that had no feeling there. And I wonder, do we mean what we say when we sing these great hymns of the faith? Do we mean what we say when we read that book? It's not so much what you do, it's why you do what you do. Now, I want to give you several, if I could please, examples of the Old Testament in the sense that sacrifice without the right motive is an abomination to God. And please, I think you have most of these down. Let me see. You may have all of them down. On number 5, under word study. Yes, I think you do have all of them there. Okay, you look up those later. It'll surprise you what those verses say. Now, you see the last little thing that says, they are doing evil. Nobody would dream that coming to church and being active and all that could be evil. But God says if your motive's wrong, doing church work is evil. For you see, what you're doing is propagating a system of self-justification, and you don't even realize it. Verse 2. It's talking about prayer, and it's a beautiful... I forgot exactly what the prayer was like, but I remember listening to some of the inauguration of presidents or of prayers at a football game or something. These guys must have never got asked to pray in public before because they bring these sheets of paper about that long. And it's all written out, and it's in theological language, and they read these beautiful, articulate, eloquent prayers.
And my mind always said, does that guy know what he's praying? You know, it sounds terrific, but does he mean it? You see, I think he's saying here that you can come to God with word after eloquent thought, with correct theology and all, but if your heart's not in your prayers don't mean much. So he's saying, remember, God's in heaven, you're on earth, and remember who you are, and make your words few. That's part of verse 2. This is exactly what Jesus said in Matthew 6, chapter verse 7. Now, in verse 3, it talks about, for the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words. I paraphrase that for you a little bit, and I want to read that paraphrase in number 8, because the word own is not supposed to be in there. As worry causes bad dreams, so a profusion of words shows one to be a fool. That same idea is going to be repeated in verse 7. Verse 7 is a very difficult verse to understand. It's simply saying, if you work hard and you're uptight and you're anxious, you're going to have dreams. I watched the Holocaust movie last night and dreamed all night about being in a concentration camp. And we're like that. If we worry about something, we take it to bed with us. We don't sleep. It's going to be used later about the problem of the rich. They worry about the loss. So it's saying as anxiety shows up in dreams, so a fool shows up in all his words. That worries me, that statement. Now, note if you would please, when it talks about verse 4, when you make a vow to God. Now, what is a vow? A vow and is that what I'm using? It's not a curse. Swearing and a vow are two different things slightly. A swear means, I swear by the throne of God that I'm telling the truth. A vow is more like, God, if you get me out of this stinking foxhole, I'll go to church every Sunday. And that's more like a vow. A swear would be to bring God into some kind of oath you're making. So this is not swearing, this is vowing. Now, the Bible has many examples of vowing to pay a tithe, vowing to give your child a Nazarite vow, and that like that. The Bible never commands anyone to vow anything. It never says vow. But boy, it says if you vow, you pay it. Woe be to the man who vows to God and does not pay it. If you've made God a promise, I don't care how hard it is to keep, best keep it. Now, probably you shouldn't have made it in the first place, because be very careful what you vow, because you can't get out of it. Now, you see where it's this thing about, if this verses 4 through 6 is almost word for word, Deuteronomy 23, 21 through 23. This man knew his Old Testament, who was writing this book. This man knew his scriptures, because he's quoting this almost word for word. Matter of fact, I've underlined in my Bible, pay what you vow. What you say, do. It always tickles me that when we say things like on a stack of Bibles, across my heart, it's just a good example of the fact that usually we're telling the truth. Not telling the truth, but we wouldn't have to say that. We'd just say, yes, I will, or no, I won't, and that'd be enough. But most of us have to get out the Bibles and call mother's name and God's name and kid's name, everybody else, they can believe it's telling the truth, because usually our life is characterized by fibs. There's a worse word for that, which I won't use. Now, notice if you would please, when it talks about, let's go down to verse 6. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God. Now, King James has the angel, doesn't it? King James has the word angel. Well, this comes from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. The word for angel and the word for messenger are the same word in Greek. It's the word angelos. It means angel, means messenger. Now, here I think what it's talking about is a priest in either one of those. And the scripture I had to back that up is Malachi chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, which says the priest is the messenger of God. Now, apparently these vows involve some kind of sacrifice or payment. And the priest that collected these vows is probably the one he's talking about don't lie in the presence of God's messenger. And notice what he's saying. The guy comes to collect the vow. And the guy says, golly, I was just kidding. I didn't mean it. Oh, I was just a slip of the tongue. That was just a little mistake on my part. What he's saying is, I was just kidding. That didn't amount to nothing. That's really not important. And seems like a Coley says here that to do that is to make God awfully angry to the point that he'll even destroy the work of your hands, the object of your prayers, if you please. But let me say again, if you've made a promise to God, best keep it. Best keep it. And don't say, it's just a little thing, a little slip, it doesn't count for anything. If you make God a promise, you best keep it. Now, notice in the last part of verse 7, if you would, for in many dreams and in many words, it's empty. So the word for empty is there is nothing less than the same word for vanity he's been using over and over again. Vanity of vanities, okay? Rather, fear God. Now, here he is summing up perfunctory religious piousity and saying, friends, don't worry about what folks think about you. Don't worry about somebody's rules. You fear and revere God, and you'll be all right. I think that's a good summary. That'd stop a lot of our problems if we tend to do that. Now, let's look at verses 8 and 9. Now, 9 is one of the most hard verses in the Hebrew to interpret. I'll bet you if we had 35 translations here tonight, we'd have 35 different understandings of this verse. It's very difficult, so let's look at it with that. If you see the oppression of the poor and the denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight, for one official watches over another official, and there is a higher official over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. Now, what's the context we can say is social injustice, right? That at least we know the main thrust of the paragraph is social injustice. And when it says denial in my translation there, denial of justice, this is the Hebrew word for robbery. The robbery of justice. And then see the word in the province there? That probably means in these faraway places from the capital where the big honcho bosses can't see what's happening, but the little petty government officials have their hands in all the pots. Now, would you say that governmental corruption is a sign of the ages? Every age has governmental corruption. Every age. Every age. Every country, every tribe, every nation. When you give men power, if they're not controlled by God, they're going to abuse the power. That's the way it is. They're going to feather their nest. They're going to say, what's best for number one? Okay? Now, notice if you would, please, I'm going to give you several possibilities to verse 9. If you'd write these down somewhere, it would be very helpful to you in going back through here. Number one, the New American Standard Version seems to imply that the king understands the plight of the poor because the king is a cotton farmer too. If you notice around voting time, how many farmers come out of the walls in elections? Everybody and his dog is a farmer when it comes to being elected, you know. And this is what it's saying here. I know what you're going through because I work in the field too, and I'm an agriculturist. So you ought to understand that. Now, number two is King James. King James begins a new paragraph at verse 9 and relates this to the money in the following paragraph. It's saying that by the cultivation of land, everybody gets the advantage, and of course the king also. The king gets the most thing. What he's saying is the land sustains everybody, and the king, being the king, gets the most of it. Okay. Now, the Vulgate, which is the Latin translation, and Loophole, my favorite commentator on Ecclesiastes, says this. They say the king here is capitalized. So they make the king God, and says Yahweh knows what you're going through, and it's an admonition to healthy work. Well, I like Loophole a whole bunch, but he just missed it 100%. There's nothing in the text that should say that we should capitalize the word king and make it God. If I had to say what it is, it seems to be that the wealth in this land was agricultural wealth. And the king had all he wanted. So the ground, everybody's fed from the ground, and the king gets the biggest hunk of that. That's the best I can do. Now, verse 10, down through verse 17, I want you to read in your translation, please. I'll give you just 2 minutes, so kind of read fast. Another way, as you're going through here, I want you to look for seven things that riches corrupt. Seven ways, or seven things that riches corrupt. Excuse me? No, there's supposed to be seven. Supposed to be seven. Seven is a perfect number, isn't okay. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. The problem is the word loves. Nothing wrong with money. Boy, you know, money is good. I tell you what, it's hard living without a little money. Now, love of money will get you. You know why? Because love is a personal relationship word. We should not love hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. We ought to love people. Love is a relationship word between two personalities. If love is consumed with objects or things or power or that or emotions, it's not love anymore. It becomes greed or lust or covetousness. Love can only be between two people. That's why God and man is described as a relationship of love. Now, the word for money here is the word silver. It's talking about why not gold? I don't know. Just a way of talking about money. Now, one problem with money is those who got it never get enough of it. You can't ever get satisfied. It eats you up. The more you get, the more you want. The more you want, the more you want. The more you want, the more you want. And on it goes. Now, notice the last part says, nor he who loves abundance. The word abundance here in the Hebrew is the word for crowd or roar. It's talking something about popularity or public acclaim. But friends, how long does the applause last? I mean, you can just clap so long and the blood in your palm starts hurting, you know? And the applause is gone. And what you left with if all you live for is the applause? If all you live for is money and you go out, come in here naked and go out of here naked, and if all you live for is applause and nobody can clap that long, you ain't got much to take with you. Matter of fact, you ain't got nothing to take with you. So, that's the word for crowd or applause. Very helpful, I think. Now, verse 11, the good things increase. Yeah? Cause and effect. The good things increase, and those who eat the goods increase. What he's saying is, money draws parasites. You make more money, you're going to have more folks who are going to spend that money for you. You got a bigger paycheck? Well, there's probably more you're going to spend that paycheck on. Now, when it says the owner sees, so what advantage to the owner except to look on? It's kind of like the guy who goes out and looks at all his cattle, you know. He's got all his cattle. He's got all this buildings and all this. Only the fact is, the more cattle you get, the more guys you got to have to work the cattle, which means your profit's less. And the bigger the ranch gets, you got to get more hands, right? And the bigger your business gets, you got to hire more people. You got to get more managers. You got to get more insurance. And you stop, and you're making less now than you were when you were a little bitty company. Isn't that sick? Isn't the way it is? So this guy, all he can say is, look what I've got. Well, man, the more you make, the more folks seem to take a bite of it. IRS must have read Ecclesiastes. Now notice it says, a guy who has worked hard all day can sleep good at night. But the guy who has ate a whole bunch and is worried about his money can't sleep at all. Have you ever, I don't know about you, one thing keeps me awake. Whenever I have to know I have to get up early, I can't sleep at all worrying about getting up early. Do you do that? You wake up and look at the alarm clock. Uh-huh, well, you know what I mean. I'm sure that folks, you know, there wasn't no banks back here. There wasn't any place to hide your money except in the walls and under trees. The guy who's got a lot to hide worries about somebody finding it. The poor guy doesn't have enough to eat anyway. He's not worried a whole lot about somebody finding what isn't there, you see. So we tend to worry about things that we're afraid men can take away from us. Tornadoes can come and blow your thing away. Or luck and all. So good sleep, it may be a real blessing sometimes. Now, notice when it says that the guy in verse 13 is a very stingy man, apparently. He hoards his riches. And then, look what happens. He makes one bad investment, and all his riches are gone. You know, one thing bad about having a lot of money is you could lose it. Either the stock market could crash, or your house could burn up, or your insurance policy could lapse, or on and on. We could get invaded by another country or something. Have you ever thought, if you don't have a whole lot, you don't miss a whole lot. But friend, if you've been up there with the eagles, it's a long fall from the eagle's nest. It's not too far from the sparrow's nest. It's a long, you know, how great the fall there was of the big men. So I think that what it's saying here is that money gets you in problems. If you get used to it, when you get without it, it makes you sick. If you haven't been used to it at all, you're sick all along anyway. Well, notice that in verse 15, the word and phrase that he says, mother, natural mother on earth. Well, Joel couldn't read my writing. It's natural mother or mother earth. It's natural mother or mother. He said, how could that be mother earth? Well, think about it. Look at the context. We come naked, we leave naked. It's kind of saying dust to dust. You came from the ground, you're going back to the ground, you know? So you came naked from your mother's womb, okay? And so you're going to go back that way, aren't you? Dust to dust. All right, notice the next little thing it says, he will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. I like to say, how much did Howard Hughes leave?
He left everything, friends.
Well, you're going to leave everything. Everything you're going to leave. Now, verse 16, same thing. Exactly as a man is born, so he will die. You know? The only thing you take with you is what? Well, I'll do a bit of the New Testament. What you've done for God. The eternal things, the riches in heaven. Now, verse 17 is another example of this. Boy, it's bad to fall when you're real tall. That's poetry, isn't it? Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. He's saying, this guy was rich, and now he's poor. He just kills him. Now, verse 18 through 20 is really a summary of a lot of things we've been talking about, so let's just go real quick through that. Jack, I'll be through in 2 minutes. We'll have time. Here's what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat and to drink and to enjoy oneself and all one's labor. Now, Ecclesiastes and Coley has said it's a recurrent theme. What's good? To enjoy what you got. Now, he's not saying ambition's bad. He's saying enjoy what you got. Be content. Now, eat and drink is just a way of talking about the natural, simple things of life. A family. A job. Food on the table. Peace when you go to sleep. Joy in your heart. Knowledge of the Lord. Friends, family, holiday festivals, love for one another, a church that cares. The simple things, eating and drinking, you know, we ought to be content with those. If we reach for the stars, if we get there, we're not happy, and it's a long way to fall from the stars. Now, so, see what it says, God has given him, last part of verse 18. I want to tell you, this old boy believed in the sovereignty of God. He believed God gave things and God took away things. I kind of agree with it. I just kind of think God's in control. I just kind of think God gives and God takes away. And God's children aren't controlled by luck and chance and circumstance and fate and horoscopes and on. We're in the hand of God, and God's going to give us good things. If we get, oftentimes we get in trouble because of our evil, selfish desires. But even God uses those to our good if we'll let him. Now, notice it says in verse 19, furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth. Now, that implies that God's given riches and wealth to everybody he loves. That's not all it's talking about. Riches and wealth here is talking about enough wealth to live. It's not talking about the superabundance of the guy that decided, man, I've got everything made, I'm going to build bigger barns, and, you know, God, tonight your soul will be required. No, it's not that kind of riches and wealth. It's riches and wealth enough to live, enough to enjoy life. And, boy, that's nice to have. Now, notice it says this is a gift of God. It's a beautiful place, if I had more than 2 minutes, to talk about God's provision and God's care. It's called the doctrine of providence. God runs out before his creation to make the way for his children to go. His children never walk anywhere the Father hadn't walked before. His children never walk anywhere if God doesn't protect them on the right and the left and before and behind and puts his cloud of glory over. Friend, you can't go anywhere God hadn't been before you. And I want to say, I'll make you be a little more Calvinistic than that. You can't go anywhere that God's not going to use it for good. Now, notice verse 20. For he will not often consider the years of his life. What do you mean? Well, man won't look back and say, golly, 1932 was the worst year of my life. It was terrible. I got bunions and corn and athlete's foot and hair fell out. No, God, what God will do is it'll help you forget the bad times and praise God for his goodness. Isn't it amazing how we tend to forget those bad times? Because we somehow have a peace that God's going to use those bad times as well as the good times. But look what it's saying. For he will not often consider or remember the years of his life or the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. God's peace, God's presence overcomes man's sorrow and man's depression and man's bad days. This is almost like saying, the peace that passes all understanding will guard your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ. Any questions? Comments? Before I leave tonight. Real quick. Number one, grasp. Verse 8. Number two, greed never satisfies. Verse 10. Number 11, for riches, you just get more parasites. Okay? No peace, no sleep. Verse 12. Fear of loss, verse 13 and 14. Can't take it with you, brother, verses 15 and 16. It's a long fall when you're way up there. verse 17. Thank you.
In our study in Ecclesiastes, we're going to be in Ecclesiastes 5 today. They're going to be dealing with several different subjects. As you know, this book jumps from subject to subject with a loose kind of identification. We're going to be dealing in verses 1 through 7 with religious formalism. We're going to be dealing in verses 8 and 9 with the poor, poverty, oppression. In verses 10 through 17, we're going to be dealing with the problem of riches. And then 18 through the end of the chapter is kind of a summary of the philosophy that Koheleth wants to give to us. Now, we must remember in a book like Ecclesiastes that we have a terrible time of interpreting because this writer is speaking tongue-in-cheek. He seems to be comparing life from two different perspectives, from man's perspective only, as if this was all there is. Man is an animal. Man is an evolved creature, one of many. Nothing inherent, nothing eternal, no God, just man. But then he also looks at life from the fact there is a loving Creator Redeemer God that is actively involved in the details of man's life on a day-by-day basis. Now, the key word for this is under the sun. He's going to characterize one perspective as the perspective of the fool or the sluggard, and the other perspective as the perspective of wisdom. Now, in chapter 5, verses 1 through 7 form a very important discussion about something that all of us were involved with, and that is piety, our love and devotion to God. I guess there is nothing that turns me off personally quicker than false piety. You know, someone just saying, praise the Lord all the time, hallelujah, Jesus. When they mean it, it's very meaningful to me. But when I catch a tone of insincerity or hypocrisy or just religious formalism, it makes me sick at my stomach. Now, I want to tell you that that's exactly what 1 through 7 is talking about. There are many religious people who do not have a personal relationship with God. There are many religious acts that can be untied to a personal commitment. You see, God wants to look at the attitude. It is crucial that the attitude is correct before the action makes any difference at all. Guard your steps as you go into the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they are doing evil. Now, guard your steps has nothing to do about attendance at the temple. The house of God means the temple, obviously. Because religion is very popular in all generations. It's not church attendance we're talking about. It's lifestyle and attitude. Why do you come to church? Now, he's saying, do you come to church just to pray beautiful prayers and do beautiful religious acts? Or do you come to church to really listen to God? And the word for listen means to listen with a view toward obeying. It's much like the image of James. James is, of course, New Testament counterpart of wisdom literature. Do not be hearers only, but be doers of the word. That's what he's saying. Listen to God and then act on that knowledge. Now, the word to offer here is not the usual word for sacrifice. Why it's different, I really do not know. But when it says the sacrifice of fools, I think we need to realize that people who do religious things, whether it's being baptized, take the Lord's Supper, repeating certain prayers, doing certain liturgies, performing certain acts, whether their motive is right or not, they feel like they're doing it for God. I mean, if you ask somebody, they'd say, well, I'm doing this because I'm a believer. But you know, 1 Corinthians 13 tells me that we can do even tremendous religious acts with a modicum of success and not be from God. It's possible to have the faith to heal, to move mountains, to speak in tongues, to perform all kind of spiritual ministries, to preach, to give away your money, to even be killed as a martyr and not have the proper motivation. Now, this deal about sacrifice, many places in the Old Testament say that God does not want sacrifice, but really, what we're saying here is not that God doesn't want sacrifice, because he's the one that instituted it. What he wants is the correct motive with the sacrifice. But see, the sacrifice without the motive is an abomination. It's just like prayer without really meaning it is an abomination. Let me give you a few verses about sacrifice and its appropriateness only with the right motive. 1 Samuel 15:22, Proverbs 21, 3 and 27, Isaiah 1, 10 through 17, Jeremiah 7, 22 and following, Hosea 6, 6, Amos 5, 22 through 24. Now, this is not negative against sacrifice. We're not saying religious ritual cannot be very meaningful. What we're saying, religious ritual to be pleasing to God must be motivated by the proper attitude of love and devotion. In verse 2 it says, "Do not be hasty in word or impulse in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God, for God is in heaven and you are on the earth, therefore let your words be few." You might want to see Matthew 6, 7. We need to realize that God is God, and He does bid us come, but there needs to be an awe and a reverence, and we need to be careful of just vain repetitions or coming into God's presence in prayer without a real sense of reverence and awe of exactly who we're talking to and what we're doing. It continues then when it says, "For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words." Now, I like to paraphrase that a little bit because I think that's hard in English to grasp. "As worry brings on fitful dreams, so a multitude of words indicates a fool." As we worry, and it has a result that we don't sleep well, so a fool is revealed by his much speaking. And how many times in Proverbs we've talked about someone speaking too much reveals their heart and reveals what they really are. Now, it continues then when it says, in verse 4, "When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for He takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow." Now, in Deuteronomy 23, 21 through 23, it talks about the fact that God does not require us to make a vow. He never says that we should do it or not do it, but He says this: if you do it, you fulfill your part of it. You know, this foxhole religion that gets in trouble and says, "Oh, God, I'll do this and this and this, you'll get me out of this trouble," that's fine. I think God honors that sometimes. But woe be unto the person who makes God a deal and then doesn't keep his part of the bargain. God didn't tell you to make all those conditions, but if you do them in faith, you best keep them. I remember one time I made a promise to God that I wish I hadn't made, but I did. And now, out of respect for who God is, and out of the honesty of my own heart, I refuse to break that promise, even though I think it's inappropriate. Well, I think if you promise Him something, you better do it. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. By the New Testament time, the rabbis had so watered this down that it almost had no meaning. They would say, well, if you vow or take an oath by the throne of heaven, it's unbinding, but if you take it by God's hair, it is binding. If you vow by this thing, it's binding, or by this thing, it's not. Jesus came to say, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Just be honest. You know, most of us today, we have our own little vows. Cross my heart and hope to die. Stick a needle in my eye. I swear on a stack of Bibles. On my mother's grave. All of those are examples of modern oaths. You know, we just need to let our yes be yes and our no be no. And I think it'll solve the problem. Okay, let's go on the next verse then where it says, "And do not let your speech cause you to sin." Sounds a lot like the book of James, doesn't it? It really does. Then it says, "And do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake." Now, King James has the word angel, but it's really not the word angel. It's the word messenger. The Hebrew word melek can mean angel or messenger, just like the Greek term angelos can mean messenger or angel. I think it's talking about the priest. You might see Malachi 2, 7 through 9. What this guy is trying to do, he's trying to say, well, listen, I was just kidding. I didn't really mean what I said. Oh, priest, I didn't mean that. You can't collect from me. I wasn't really serious. Friends, and look at the rest of this verse where it says, "Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands?" Don't try to get out of it. If you said it, do it. The trick is, don't make any rash vows. Boy, they'll cause you misery. Now, beginning in verse 7 where it says, "For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. Rather fear God." This has been his whole emphasis. Excuse me. An attitude of life that gives God a place is what Coley is trying to convince us of. Life without God is misery when you think about it. It's nothing. It's vain. It's empty. It's purposeless. But life with God is significant. And we can't understand all about God. We can't know God completely. But we respect Him. We enjoy life on a daily basis. Be careful of speaking too much. Be careful of formal ritualism. Love God. That's the emphasis here. Now, in verses 8 and 9 seems to be a going back to the oppression of the poor. God really is concerned for poor people. He's concerned with the physically and socially and emotionally oppressed. He's concerned with the alienated, the outcast, and the orphan, and the widow, and the stranger. God really cares for people who no one cares about. Now, it says, if you see oppression of the poor and the denial, that's the word robbery, of justice and righteousness in the province. Now, obviously, he's saying away from the capital. You see, when the king or the officers are looking, everybody acts so nice, they do things so wonderful, they all... But when you get out in the country, away from the centralized government, that's where the abuse comes. Do not be shocked at the sight of one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. I think governmental corruption or bureaucratical foul-ups and injustice is just part of human society organized apart from God. It's in every age. It's certainly in ours, and it certainly was in Israel, but it's inappropriate. Now, verse 9 is a real problem verse. There have been many theories about verse 9, how to handle this. Let me show you a slate of those theories, if I could, please. The first one of them is from New American Standard Version, and it translates it such that it seems to imply that the king understands the plight of the poor because he himself works. Or there's King James. King James starts a new paragraph in verse 9 and relates it to the subject of money, which follows. Okay? Number 3, the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate of Jerome, and the commentator Loophole, they both say the king refers to Yahweh, and therefore it's a reference here to God dealing with injustice. And those are the three basic theories of verse 9. All right, let's go on then to verse 10 and 11. 10 begins a subject. It's going to go through verse 17. I'm going to wait to verse 17 to summarize this, and we have a chart we want to show you at the end of verse 17 that'll show you all of the problems of money. But, you know, Ecclesiastes is really a commentary on the false security of wealth and possession. You see, we think if we just had money, we'd be happy. But this book, of all the Bible, says that's a false philosophy. And we ought to know that because the rich folks we know are not always the happiest folks we know. Listen to what it says about money. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Now, that sounds a whole lot like 1 Timothy 6:10. The love of money is the root of all evil. Now, it's not money. Money is not the problem. I know some great, spiritually mature, wealthy Christians, and I thank God for them. But you see, money is in its proper perspective. It's the priority of money that's the problem. Now, one of the things that amazed me looking at wealthy people is they never have enough. I don't care how much money they got. I don't care how many cars in the garage or how many houses or how many bank accounts or how much insurance. Rich people, if they don't know God, are never satisfied. And they work themselves to death without ever enjoying what they have because they always want more. Now, it continues then, nor he who loves abundance with its income. Now, the word abundance is the word crowd or roar, and possibly it means the wanting the fame of the crowd or the applause of the crowd. So someone who is seeking money or power and position and fame is going to never, never be satisfied. They're going to have a longing search for this that'll never get over. Now, this too is vanity, and of course the word vanity means vain, empty. Verse 11. When good things increase, those who consume them also increase. So what is the advantage to the owners except to look on? I've entitled this, when you get wealthy, just mark it down because the folks who want to mooch off your wealth are going to increase. It's always amazed me, the guy who gets a bigger... Let's take a Let's say a cotton farmer. I'm from Lubbock, Texas here right now. Let's say a cotton farmer who happens to get more land. He plants more cotton. Well, then he's got to hire more people to work that cotton. And he's got to buy more machines to harvest that cotton. Then he's got to hire more folks to service those machines and more implements to go on those machines. In the end, he's not making any more money. He's really paying out more money, but he sits back and says, look at all I've got. Friends, when you get the things of this world, the people of this world will beat their path to your door, try to mooch off what you got. That's just reality. That's just the way it is. Number 12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of a rich man does not allow him to sleep. When a laborer who's worked hard all day eats what he's got and goes to bed, he sleeps well. But the rich guy's afraid someone's going to steal it. Hurricane's going to come. Tornado's going to come. The bugs are going to eat it up. Robbers are going to come. He worries all the time about losing what he has. If you don't have anything, you don't worry about losing it. One of the problems of having a whole lot is you're always worried about someone else getting it, someone taking it away. Verse 13, there is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun. There's that key phrase, life without God. Riches being hoarded by their owner to his own hurt. Now, what does this mean? The more we tend to accumulate, the more it tends to destroy our joy in what we have. And I think that's what it's talking about. Riches, accumulated wealth, ought to be a blessing, but they turn out to be a curse. They become our master instead of us being their master. And here's one example of that. When those riches were lost through a bad investment and he has father or son, then there was nothing to support him. There's one example of a guy trying to accumulate things, but he lost it all. Verse 15. As when he came naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. Well, I'm just saying this way. If you accumulate a whole lot of wealth, you ain't taking it with you. Isn't it a disaster that people work so hard and so many hours and push, push, push to get worldly things? Then in a moment, they're not of any value. You've heard the little saying, you can't take it with you. It's really true. And why do we push so hard for those things that in the end we leave to someone else? And Coley says, and how do you know your son won't be a fool, right? Get all this stuff and he may abuse it. So